You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Lost Illusions by Maureen Ryan. I wasn't the only critic to point out how uneven the island saga had gotten as it entered its home stretch, but many of us agreed that Ab Eterno was a blast. The episode's credited writers, Sue Taylor, and script coordinator Gregory Nations crafted a rousing adventure tale that filled in the backstory of fan favorite Richard Alpert, Nestor Carbonell. The only problem was that an episode without Lindelof's and Cuse's names on it was so well received. Sue Taylor, like most Lost veterans I've talked to, is quick to point out that working on the show was an intensely collaborative effort. The grind of making 14 to 25 episodes of TV per season, as the Lost team did, was so demanding that it was not uncommon for a number of writers to work together to get a script across the finish line. That's what happened with Ab Eterno. "We had such a talented staff," Sue Taylor said. "I am so grateful for everything that everybody did, but my name and Greg's name were on the script, and I did do a pass to stitch it all together and smooth things out. I wrote a bunch of the scenes, too, and I was really proud of the results." That's why she was thunderstruck when, in the anteroom to Cuse's office, she heard him on the phone with Carbonell. In Sue Taylor's recollection, Cuse said to the actor, "Oh, yeah, I wrote that. I wrote most of that script." "I mean, it was a flat-out lie," Sue Taylor said. "My jaw dropped. I just turned around and walked away." She was devastated. At one point, the Ab Eterno saga took a turn for the ridiculous. Cuse and Lindelof called Nations and Sue Taylor into a room, and she recalled that they basically told us how much we owed them for letting us have our names on that script. And they implied it would probably be good if we got them a little present. So Sue Taylor went out and bought gifts for her bosses. She can't recall what she got Lindelof, probably something Star Wars related, given his love of that franchise. She said she bought Swarovski pencils for Cuse. As the episode got more and more praise, they started to get more and more tense about it, Sue Taylor recalled. "I was up next in the rotation. I was supposed to write one of the upcoming episodes. We were in the writer's room. I remember Carlton walking around the table while doling out script assignments. Sue Taylor recalled feeling that he was making sure everyone was fully aware that he was skipping her. Later, when the bosses weren't around, the other writers were sympathetic, she told me. They were like, 'Yes, you're absolutely being punished for having co-written that script.' To this day, Owusu Breen is extremely cautious about what jobs she takes. She talks to assistants, support staff, anyone she can get hold of. 'I can't work for certain people and do good work. I'm a black woman, and if you don't accept that, I can't change,' she said. Lost, she added, was the most nakedly hostile work environment she'd ever experienced. When Owusu Breen and her writing partner joined the ABC drama Brothers and Sisters, they were required to attend a seminar on avoiding and preventing racial and sexual harassment. Afterward, they went up to the people who ran the seminar and said, 'Have you done this on Lost? Because they actually need to be reminded of all this,' Owusu Breen recalled. 'They just walked away from us, like that meme of Homer Simpson disappearing into the bush. They were walking backward like, 'No, no, we haven't done that yet. We're going to.' You could tell everyone knew it was a toxic work environment, but it was a huge hit. After they were fired from Lost, they had one other deeply surreal experience connected to the show. We were taken out to lunch by executives, and told there was no racism, it was just bullying, Owusu Breen told me. It was fascinating to me because what do you think racism is? As she sees it, we were discriminated against on the daily. Maybe they just didn't like our writing, but it's hard to tell if you're discriminated against on the daily. Why dredge all this up years later? Because working on Lost harmed a lot of people, and some are still dealing with the after effects of that personal and professional damage. It's the sort of place where the voices still ring in your head even now, Sue Taylor said. You don't know you're in an abusive relationship until you're no longer in an abusive relationship, said Seamus. In a separate interview, Gretchen said almost the same thing, word for word. Another reason to go into all this is because, well, Lost is still around. Thanks to the streaming revolution, the shows of the Golden Age are available with a click or two. Complicating and adding necessary context to the show's influential legacy is important. Plus, the tendency to engage in hero worship of geniuses is very much alive and well. If we don't question the more damaging aspects of our conception of genius, we are doomed to repeat the past ad nauseam, and we'll get shittier entertainment. This sort of environment doesn't only poison the dynamic behind the scenes, it shows up on screen in the attitudes of the characters, their dialogue, and the stories themselves, said Griot Marchrot. It's no surprise to me that the main Latinx character in the show was frequently portrayed as feckless, ignorant, and gluttonous, and therefore the butt of countless fat jokes. It's very easy, especially 20 years after the fact, to think, well, it can't have been that bad, or someone would have done something. Let me say it loud and clear, it was that bad, and no one did anything, because retribution was a constant and looming presence. What remains a foundational pillar of the industry is the fact that those responsible for huge hits often get enormous passes regarding their actions, attitudes, and management styles. Very few people who are put in positions of power get the training or oversight they need to make the workplace a positive, or at least non-miserable, experience for everyone involved. If some powerful people want to act like despots and cruel dictators, no one will stop them, despite the fact that being a decent and accountable human being in this industry is not all that hard, Owusu Breen observed. Simple decency and managerial experience, Griot Marchrot said, are not mutually dependent. I've known Damon Lindelof a long time. My career has prospered over the years for a number of reasons, but one thing that has certainly helped is knowing that powerful people like him tend to return my call, text, or email. They want to promote their projects, and they hope for good coverage, but in many cases, there's more to it than the merely transactional. We often wonder about the same things, why some stories work and some don't, why some careers prosper and some founder. We can lose hours gossiping about various industry trash fires. In any event, having conversations with industry people is not just useful, it's often pleasant and even illuminating. We had two conversations for this book. All in all, he spent a couple of hours talking about what went very wrong at Lost. My level of fundamental inexperience as a manager and a boss, my role as someone who was supposed to model a climate of creative danger and risk-taking, but provide safety and comfort inside of the creative process. I failed in that endeavor, Lindelof said when we spoke in 2021. In that conversation, he also addressed Hollywood tokenism that was common at the time and is still not hard to find. That's what I saw in the business around me, Lindelof observed. And so I was like, okay, as long as there are one or two writers who don't look and think exactly like me, then I'm okay. I came to learn that was even worse. For those specific individuals, forget about the ethics or the morality involved around that decision, but just talking about the human effect of being the only woman or the only person of color and how you were treated and othered, I was a part of that 1,000%. After that first conversation, I kept talking to lost veterans, and I heard awful things. It was not an easy process, because airing all of this out can feel, as Owusu Breen put it, like revealing Santa doesn't exist. People just love Lost so much. I talked to Lindelof a second time in 2022 and shared additional allegations I'd heard, many of which touched more deeply on matters of race and gender. Multiple sources, including some who heard it said in their presence, had told me they'd heard Lindelof say he fired Perrineau because he felt accused of racism by the actor. I told him the two versions of this remark that I'd heard ended with "so I fired him" or "so I fired his ass." "What can I say, other than it breaks my heart that that was Harold's experience," replied Lindelof, who said he did not recall ever saying that. "And I'll just cede that the events that you're describing happened 17 years ago, and I don't know why anybody would make that up about me." Lindelof said the rapid growth spurt of Malcolm David Kelly, the actor who played Walt, Michael's son, factored into the showrunner's thinking about what to do with both characters. "When I shared Perrineau's comments about black families missing black boys and Hollywood stereotypes, Lindelof replied that there was a high degree of insensitivity towards all the issues that you mentioned as it relates to Harold." Lindelof added that by the second season, every single actor had expressed some degree of disappointment that they weren't being used enough. That was kind of part and parcel for an ensemble show, but obviously there was a disproportionate amount of focus on Jack and Kate and Locke and Sawyer, the white characters. Harold was completely and totally right to point that out. "It's one of the things that I've had deep and profound regrets about in the two decades since." "All in all," Lindelof said, "I do feel that Harold was legitimately and professionally conveying concerns about his character and how significant it was that Michael and Walt, with the exception of Rose, were really the only black characters on the show." Lindelof told me he didn't remember any negative incident with an editor, adding that he seeks out input from collaborators and that he's never threatened anyone's career. Lindelof also said he had no recollection of anything Sue Taylor said about events connected to Abby Terno. He said she was a great writer who executed at a high level, and he's stricken that she was made to feel the way she felt at that time. Regarding the other allegations leveled at him and the show, Lindelof said he had no memory of the incidents and comments I related. He told me he was shocked and appalled and surprised by the incidents I described to him, and said more than once that he did not think anyone was making anything up. "I just can't imagine that Carlton would have said something like that, or some of those attributions, some of those comments that you shared. I'm telling you, I swear I have no recollection of those specific things. And that's not me saying that they didn't happen. I'm just saying that it's literally baffling my brain that they did happen and that I bore witness to them or that I said them. To think that they came out of my mouth or the mouths of people that I still consider friends is just not computing." For his part, Cuse said he was not present for, nor did he hear, the litany of offensive comments that I brought up, and he added, "I deeply regret that anyone at Lost would have to hear them. They are highly insensitive, inappropriate, and offensive." Cuse, who supplied written answers to my questions through a PR representative, also stated he had never made an actor cry. Cuse's comments were similar to Lindelof's on the matter of Kelly's growth spurt and how it collided with the island drama's plot. "Kelly's rapid growth created continuity problems for Lost, hence the need, cited by both showrunners, to write him out of the narrative. And if Walt was gone, Q said the only thing to do with Michael was to make finding the boy his primary mission. However, since Kelly was not coming back, that was not a storyline they could resolve for the character, Cuse added. We did not know how to solve this problem, other than to resolve Michael's story at the end of season two. Cuse also stated that he never discussed matters touching on race at any time with Perrineau, and that race had nothing to do with the character's storyline. I do not believe he is in any way personally to blame for the way his role changed, said Cuse, who also noted that Perrineau's feedback about that script was relayed to him by Lindelof. Cuse did not recall discussing those specific concerns with the actor. And that revisions of the script were in part intended to address Perrineau's input. We heard his concerns and made changes to address them in the second episode of season two, and as we moved through season two, we reflected Michael's character as caring deeply about finding his missing son at every possible opportunity, Cuse wrote. In his responses, Cuse disputed that Perrineau was fired. He said the actor was bumped down to recurring status, but that does not line up with Perrineau's recollections. The actor said after season two, he was released from his lost contract and took other jobs. As the opening credits show, he was not part of season three at all. Perrineau did appear in several episodes of the strike-shortened fourth season, and he also appeared once in the final season. As for Cuse's remark to Owusu Breen about Mr. Echo's death, this was Cuse's response to a query about it. I never, ever made that statement above, and this exchange never happened. To further add to this lie and suggest that someone was fired as a result of a statement that I never made is completely false, adding that the implication is completely outrageous. Hundreds of people were employed in various capacities by Lost. Some had, at times, genuinely positive experiences, and that was and is a good thing. But in the engine room of the show, where decisions about theme, story, and focus were made, where characters and plots duked it out for attention, the atmosphere was often demeaning, unpleasant, and confounding, at least to some. One person said of their bosses and some of their co-workers, I think they were having a different experience of reality, which was, wow, I just have a bunch of funny people I work with. This source felt silenced because it felt as though every pathway, other than accepting the cruelty, sexism, and racist commentary, was blocked. I kept a running list of words sources used to describe the show's work atmosphere, a word cloud I shared with Lindelof and Cuse. Among the adjectives that came up a lot, cruel, brutal, destructive, racist, sexist, bullying, angry, abusive, and hostile. It breaks my heart to hear it. It's deeply upsetting to know that there were people who had such bad experiences, Cuse wrote to me. I did not know people were feeling that way. No one ever complained to me, nor am I aware that anybody complained to ABC Studios. I wish I had known. I would have done what I could to make changes. I also asked Cuse the following question. It's my understanding that there were several tiers of compensation among actors on Lost, and that after negotiations during the show's run, white actors were in the top compensation tier. Why was that? Cuse wrote that he and Lindelof steadfastly believed that the actors' compensation should all be the same. While we did not support changes to how the actors were compensated, ultimately those decisions were made by ABC Studios. He wrote that he did not recall withholding a script from Sue Taylor, whom he called an invaluable asset to Lost, nor did he remember claiming credit for Ava Terno or implying that she should buy presents for the showrunners. He called the latter claim absurd. Regardless of our level of writing on Ava Terno, we never sought credit for our work on the episode, Cuse wrote. As for the high writer turnover, which he acknowledged especially affected early seasons, he wrote that the complexity of the show's narrative, themes, and logistics made it very difficult for us to find writers who could accomplish all the many things we felt we needed from them. Looking back, I can understand that the high degree of writer turnover caused hurt, resentment, and frustration, and I am sorry for that. After I read The Word Cloud to Lindelof, he was silent for about a minute. He finally answered, referring to his behavior in the present. "The way that I conduct myself and the way that I treat other humans who I am responsible for and a manager of is a byproduct of all the mistakes that were made. I have significantly evolved and grown, and it shouldn't have had to come at the cost and the trauma of people that I hurt on Lost." Lindelof asked, "Would it shock you to learn or believe that, despite the fact that I completely and totally validate your word cloud, that I was oblivious, largely oblivious, to the adverse impacts that I was having on others in that writer's room during the entire time that the show was happening?" He also asked, "Do you feel like I knew the whole time and just kept doing it?" I gave him a variation of an answer I have given, or wanted to give, to powerful people many times. I think he knew enough and chose not to do anything about it. But in our culture, phrases like, "I didn't know, there was so much going on, and mistakes were made," are common ways to frame terrible patterns of behavior, many of which are the result of terrible decisions, not the work of the disembodied hand of fate. Especially if the person at the center of those mistakes is a high-status individual, a lot of hedges and rationales are rolled out, and they are often couched in the passive voice. In the past decade alone, how many times and in how many important spheres have we seen wealthy or powerful people, especially white men, depicted as stumbling bumblers who knew not what they did? But someone in their early 30s, as Lindelof was when Lost took off like a rocket, is not a child. Lindelof and Cuse were adults when the show began, and both had been in the industry for years. They were the two people within that workplace who had power, and they bear the responsibility for the culture you read about here, one that endured for 6 seasons. Nothing that happens consistently across the making of more than 100 episodes of television happens by accident. Whether or not Lindelof and Cuse were present for every damaging incident, the workplace environment at Lost was created, rewarded, and reinforced by them. I said as much to Lindelof. "Of course," he replied, "yeah, full stop, of course, you're right." Toward the end of that second conversation, Lindelof began speculating about what would happen to his career as a result of this book. He sounded as demoralized as I felt. "It's not for me to say what kind of person I am," he said, "but I will say this. I would trade every person who told you that I was talented. I would rather they said I was untalented but decent, rather than a talented monster." That is a false binary. People can be talented and decent. Lindelof's framing is one I encounter a lot, and it belies, or at least hints at, the fundamental belief that if you're a genius, you're more or less required to be a monster. But at its heart, and at its best, it has a palpable, beating heart. Lost tries to say that none of us have to be defined by our past. We're at the beginning of the entertainment industry's shift to better models, and to make the necessary changes, a lot of people must work hard on a number of fronts for a long time. But what choice do we have? As the Lost saying goes, live together, die alone. Starlight. This year's Emmys are more competitive than ever. Vanity Fair honors some of the season's most arresting performers. Photographs by Dan Jackson, styled by Caitlin Gray. And pictured here are Elizabeth Olsen, Love and Death, Max. Cheryl Lee Ralph, Abbott Elementary, ABC. Claire Danes, Fleischman is in Trouble, FX. Riley Keough, Daisy Jones and the Six, Prime Video. J. Smith Cameron, Succession, HBO. Niecy Nash-Betts, Dahmer, Netflix. Lizzie Kaplan, Fleischman is in Trouble, Fatal Attraction, FX, Paramount Plus. Sharon Horgan, Bad Sisters, Apple TV Plus. And Dominique Fishback, Swarm, Prime Video.
Thank you.
The Hangover, billions in losses, sweeping layoffs and restructuring, a writer's strike. Now that the streaming bubble has burst, the TV industry has woken up with an excruciating headache. By Joy Press and Natalie Jarvie, with opening illustration of the writers looking perplexed and upset by Jorge Arevalo. The golden age of streaming didn't always reward the people who actually mined the gold. Back in 2017, around the time that The Handmaid's Tale emerged as a global hit for Hulu and became the first streaming show ever to win the top drama Emmy, one of its writers, John Herrera, was working a second job. The good news was that he still heard some solid gossip from Hollywood insiders, or overheard, to be more accurate. They were talking to each other in the back of his lift. There were a couple of instances of driving people to LAX and dropping them off while a billboard for Handmaids was staring down at me, he says. And that was the golden age. The streamer's appetite for originality and niche programming was once their chief selling point, apart from us not having to go outside. But that's declined since Netflix's loss of subscribers caused the company's market cap to dip $54 billion last year, and Disney, NBC Universal, and Paramount accumulated more than $8.3 billion in streaming losses. Wall Street, unsurprisingly, is second-guessing the throw-everything-at-the-wall mentality that fueled the streaming arms race. Now, Disney, Warner Brothers, Discovery, and others have laid off thousands of staffers, pulled the plug on underperforming programming, and vowed to be more cautious. On top of all that, the threat of a writer's strike slowed production even before the WGA hit the picket lines on May 2nd. People are just desperate, says David H. Steinberg, a writer and showrunner. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I've never been in a situation where people are like, oh, no one's buying anything right now. We just can't sell. The buyers are obviously not having the time of their lives either. Part of HBO's appeal has always been that it's selective about what it makes. Casey Bloys, the chairman and CEO of HBO and Max Content, and his team have delivered Succession, Euphoria, The Last of Us, The White Lotus, Mayor of Easttown, and House of the Dragon, so you could argue that they know exactly what they're doing. But several sources say they were surprised and disconcerted last year when HBO pulled the handbrake on what seemed to them like an unusual number of projects. There are all kinds of reasons for not making a series, like when it hasn't coalesced in the way everybody had hoped. But Bloys now reports to Warner Brothers. Discovery president and CEO David Zaslav, who's on a mission to drive shareholder price up by cutting cost and easing the debt load. At HBO, the creative direction and commitment remains exactly the same, the company says in a statement. All one needs to do is look at our robust slate, and it's obvious that our programming remains unchanged. It's true big money still flows for potential blockbusters, but there's concern in the industry that smaller gems are being sidelined. In a Wall Street investor call, David Zaslav said that Casey Bloys is an effing unicorn, says one dealmaker, and yet he's really just cutting his horn off, you know. To be fair, everybody is learning to curb their enthusiasm. Wall Street changed the rules of the game, says Mark Guggenheim, a veteran showrunner. Instead of chasing subscriber growth with great content, streamers are now directed to focus on profitability. Overnight, all the streamers will suddenly be measured by a completely different yardstick that they weren't built to meet. Guggenheim compares the companies to a car speeding down a highway at 100 miles per hour. Suddenly, they slam on the brakes, and the car spends a little time skidding out of control. I picture Ted Sarandos white-knuckling the steering wheel going, okay, well, that was fun, but let's get the heart rate down now. The financial pressure on streamers has caused a parade of panic. Everyone in the industry is freaking out because things are getting cut left and right, says a former studio executive. What's being cut big time is development, and that's where most of this town is. I'm working on a project. How often have you heard that? It takes time and care to bring truly original shows into the world. I'm worried about that pipeline, not just at HBO, but at Showtime, Hulu, FX, and others, getting their budgets cut as things get consolidated, says the exec. You get to a White Lotus because HBO nurtured Mike White and Enlightened. You get to an Everything Everywhere All at Once because A24 nurtured the Daniels. Over the past few months, we talked to dozens of executives, writers, producers, crew members, actors, directors, and dealmakers, many of whom ask for anonymity, as people in Hollywood tend to do when they're going to tell the truth. One award-winning showrunner thinks of the streaming revolution as an earthquake with a series of aftershocks. And I guess the question really is, at the end of the quakes, are we going to be better off or worse off? She lets out a ragged sigh. It doesn't look good. Without question, the streaming boom was a miraculous turn of events for TV addicts who liked their entertainment smart, challenging, and on tap. Platforms lured talent by offering creative freedom and bags of cash up front. No more commercial breaks. No more intrusive network notes like, we're really craving more heart, and we just don't like her. Creators could break taboos, experiment with genres, and make binge-worthy masterpieces. The result was a wave of idiosyncratic series that transformed our idea of television. Think of Fleabag's madcap, sex-soaked journey through grief. Severance's Orwellian take on office culture. BoJack Horseman's Talking Horse and his meta critique of Hollywood, Reservation Dogs' imaginative evisceration of our myths about indigenous Americans, and Station 11's poetic vision of a post-apocalyptic world. As soon as Netflix started streaming original programming in 2012, every major media and tech company scrambled to get a foothold in this new landscape. The execs had seen the music industry get ambushed by streaming, and nobody wanted to go broke and have to pull their kids out of Harvard Westlake. Was it clear how streaming platforms would coexist with broadcast and cable? Nope. Was it even clear how streamers would make enough money to justify what they paid top talent? Nope. The sequel. Regardless, corporations threw themselves into the fray. All these platforms were brand new, trying to make noise and grab cultural attention, says the showrunner behind a buzzy series. One way to do it was to have all these highly original, highly creative, highly expensive, premium limited series with huge movie stars getting to do a lot of really experimental stuff. It was like Funny Money that was funding all this as a way of announcing, we're here, we're part of the party. The number of scripted series soared. In 2022, 599 English-language scripted shows were released, according to research from FX, which is headed by John Landgraf, the executive who coined the term peak TV to describe the glut of programming. That's more than double the number tallied for 2012, and doesn't even include unscripted and variety series. The rise of international shows, many of them riveting, was just as dizzying. With so many productions on the go simultaneously, the inevitable feeding frenzy ensued, and a lot of good came out of it. Formerly strict hierarchies hired new faces. Streamers welcomed novelists, playwrights, and journalists with open checkbooks. Studios dispensed lucrative overall deals to top writers, directors, actors, and producers. An overall deal means the studio has you locked down, but at least you're rich. A handful of household name showrunners, like Ryan Murphy and Shonda Rhimes, scored stratospheric nine-figure deals, suggesting that Hollywood was a prospector's paradise. But the collateral damage was no joke. The networks used to employ tons of people just to create and shoot pilots for a zillion shows that never saw the light of day. And if a broadcast show did make it into America's living rooms, it'd have at least 20 episodes every season, which meant people had steady employment on a single series all year. Actors, writers, and directors would also get residual checks every time an episode was rerun, the way songwriters get royalties. For some TV creatives, it could have a big impact on their bottom line if their show was sold into syndication. People in the industry love to trash network TV as timid and formulaic, but it didn't just bring many of them to the dance. It bought them second homes in Ojai. Streaming was a sea change. Transparency about viewership disappeared. Pilots were gone. TV seasons were drastically shorter, and workers on all levels had to patch together gigs to make what they used to make on one show. Everybody relying on substantial residual or syndication checks was largely out of luck. What does the word rerun even mean now? Streamers are making the same product, but they changed the delivery system, so they barely have to pay anybody any residuals, says a showrunner. I make way more from residuals from a network show that I worked on many years ago than I do on anything that I've done on a streamer. It's only because of the broadcast checks that he can laugh about the time a streamer sent him one for a penny. None of the top-tier execs and writers we talked to expects anybody to weep for them, but the streamer's pivot has upended everything. Like Uber, they changed culture and only then realized their business model was unsustainable. Now they're aggressively cutting back on deals with talent, the number of original scripted shows they're making, and the budgets attached to remaining projects. I certainly know people, myself included, who realistically might have thought a year or two ago that they'd be renegotiating for multi-million dollar overall deals, says a prominent showrunner. Now it's like, oh, there's not going to be any deal for me at all. In other words, welcome to peaked TV. For a handful of years now, series creators and writers have considered mini room a particularly ugly word. The mini room is one of the most harmful things that has happened to writers, says another showrunner. Everybody hopes that they will lead to real jobs, but if they don't, it's like every 10 weeks you're trying to get a new job. Mini rooms, fewer people doing the same amount of work with even less security, are egalitarian in the sense that they seem bad for everyone. AMC was an early adopter, and others have made use of them. TV writer-producer Liz Sayo-Lanalper says that because experienced writers and novices are paid the same rate in mini rooms, some studios are hiring only upper-level writers to get the most bang for their buck. It's basically making it so that there are fewer and fewer lower- and middle-level writers who can make a living, she says. And in the WGA, most of our diversity is found amongst our lower and middle tiers. This was not the dream, to put it mildly. I babysat in fancy writers' houses when I was coming up as an assistant, and I thought, oh, when I get to that level, that's what I'll have, says writer and showrunner Emily Silver. But she climbed the industry ladder only to discover the steps disintegrating. The future I saw in front of me, it's not there. Do I need to sell my house? I've seen a lot of people move out of Los Angeles in the last few years, and that is something that has been on my mind. We haven't gone on vacation since the pandemic, because I don't know if I'm going to make any more money ever again, says one veteran writer. That's the panic. That's what I worry about. The sad part about the business, and I don't tell this to people that are trying to break in, is that no one tells you when your career's over. They don't call you up and say, I've got some bad news, you're never going to work again. If you're in the mood for irony, there's plenty to feast on these days. Some folks are now running back to network TV. There was a moment where everyone turned away from broadcast, says a television agent, and then people saw how hard it was in streaming. One writer points out that with streamers cutting the number of writers they hire for each show and the number of episodes they'll pay for, working on a time-tested network procedural is a dream. He estimates that writing and producing just one episode of a broadcast show could end up paying $150,000 over time. Knock out a number of them and you can retire on the residuals. Here's another irony if you're still hungry. Everyone poo-pooed network television, says a veteran television writer. They said, we're going to make these dark anti-hero shows. We're going to take big swings. And guess what the streamers want now? They basically want what network shows were 10 years ago. Netflix would kill for a Big Bang Theory. If you think of Hollywood as one giant Tesla parking lot, keep in mind that there are many income brackets in the TV industry. One editor who works on streaming TV series has witnessed real class resentment. They're hiring the stars for $5 million for 20 days of work or whatever, and if the star is like, I don't like that pimple on my cheek, they'll spend thousands to remove it in VFX, no question. Do you need that $5 million when this person gets $10,000? Considering it's supposed to be liberal Hollywood, it's kind of the worst when it comes to income disparity. The WGA is well aware that writers aren't the only endangered class. Our employers are squeezing every worker in Hollywood in order to shake out a few more pennies to put into the pockets of the Wall Street boards, who are demanding that they get at least as much or more profits than they have in the previous years in order to keep up that growth, says Alper. And we're being squeezed in a way that's no longer sustainable. In the last few years, Hollywood's VFX workers have been in demand thanks to the proliferation of special effects-heavy streaming shows and movies, but they say they're working long hours for low pay in sometimes unsafe conditions. In a 2022 survey, nearly 70% of VFX workers who responded felt their work was not doable long-term. I can't fathom any future where I can retire, one anonymous VFX professional confessed in the poll. Another wrote, things like stress, depression, and burnout have become built-in aspects of the job. There's already no middle class in L.A., says a studio executive. I don't know how L.A. as a city sustains itself in future generations, because people are just going to make so much less money over time than they have for the last 30 years or so. California, thanks in part to the downturn in entertainment and tech, has gone from a nearly $100 billion budget surplus to a projected $22.5 billion deficit in the last year. A lot of people within the industry knew that a reckoning was on its way. This correction was necessary, and we've all been dreading it, says another studio exec. For one thing, so many series were launched that even shows with marquee names have sunk beneath the waves. Do you remember the Julia Roberts series on Stars last year? What was it called? How about Samuel L. Jackson's series on Apple TV Plus? And they were good shows. All this has led to some messy moments as corporate overlords try to rein in their streaming Frankensteins. One of the more surprising side effects was the decision by some companies, most notably Warner Brothers Discovery, to pull existing original series off their streaming services. Or simply mothball shows that have already been shot to cut cost. Prime Video's new franchise, Citadel, has undergone reshoots, one television agent notes. They're looking at it as a potential global hit, so they can find money for that. And Netflix found money for the three-body problem, the high-budget forthcoming sci-fi adaptation from Alexander Wu, and the Game of Thrones creators David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. What's not happening is the flyers, the shows that gave artists a feeling that anyone could come from anywhere. Cynicism about the industry is, more than ever, the mood of the day. What they're doing is going to create an erosion of the quality of the product, says Brittany Nichols, a writer-producer on Abbott Elementary. I just don't understand how you could piss off writers, piss off your audiences, and then tell them, but we need you to sign up for these 18 different streaming services. Another writer puts it this way. When someone comes to me with an idea now, I'm like, who gets murdered? And where are the zombies? You can hide cool character stuff in the zombie show, but you can't just have a show about cool characters anymore. Showtime, which like HBO is one of the original prestige cable networks, is being integrated with Paramount Plus. Chris McCarthy, who oversees Paramount Media Networks and Showtime, speaks plainly about his franchise-flavored ambitions. We're not playing to the coast. We're playing to the center of the country and the coast, he says. I think we proved the model first with Yellowstone, that you make a premium scripted series into a franchise and make it fresh and new. Franchise fever is also driving McCarthy's plans to extend the universe of series like Dexter and Billions. Look out for Millions and Trillions. What the franchises do is just set a much more stable base that brings us a mass audience. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.